You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From a dusty studio that is too ramshackle for a man of my exquisite tastes, I'm Lionel Silverblatt, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. I'm here because Mr. Segundo cannot make it, and while my dearest brother Michael is busy in Santa Monica, I have considerable hubris to fill. Our guest this week is Scott Smith, a novelist who even my stunning intellect cannot get behind, and we'll be talking with him very soon, but I must note that I am very angry at my brother, who thinks that he is smarter than me, and got a plug from Susan Sontag that he constantly boasts about. And I want to do something very bad to him, like sodomize him in front of a paying audience, but anyway, that's not important. Scott, it's a pleasure to have you. I want to ask you about this South American journey, in which I detected a slight reference to Nabokov's Pale Fire. Scott? Scott, where are you?
Yeah, Lionel, that's enough.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, we're done here. We've already done the interview. We've got a guy who doesn't name the Young Roving Correspondent. Scott's not here.
But I thought I was here to interview an author the way that Michael does, with such questionable panache.
Lionel, just take your $5 and leave. We just needed an intro. We're done with you. And please, please do take the smoked Gouda with you. It's really stinking up the studio.
But I...
Lionel, see a therapist.
So I am here with Scott Smith, author of The Ruins, most recently, as well as A Simple Plan. It's a pleasure to talk with him. Scott, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Thanks. I'm doing pretty well, and I hope you're doing the same.
Yeah.
Now, I actually wanted to go ahead and first off... state the obvious kind of question, and that is, you know, I read this book. I couldn't put it down. I came across sort of like hoping for some sort of literary equivalent of methadone or something. did you intend to grab the readers by the lapels with this book? Because this book is a sort of unputdownable, as people have been saying.
Yeah, I think it had been so long since I'd written a book that coming back to it, I think that I feel confident in myself as a storytelling type writer. And I think I wanted to use that as a crutch almost. So I gravitated toward the genre, the horror genre, as a means to, I guess, just reassure myself that, okay, I can handle this, you know, as I went back into it.
Well, I guess, though, the question is, you know, in terms of just, you know, really sort of making this an addictive book that you can't put down, I mean, when did this actually, as you were writing the book, kind of, when were you conscious of this? Because I know that you wrote... Oh, go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't think... probably not. When was I conscious of...
When were you conscious that this was like a plot that would essentially, you know... I mean, you had to have kind of known at some point along the line that, like, oh, my God, this plot is just... this narrative is just really, you know, it grips you. It will grip the reader. Did you have any...
not at all. No, not at all. Not. My wife was the first person that read it, and she was... very kind of obsessively into it, which I didn't know whether it was just, you know, the loyalty or not. But writing that, I was very insecure writing it. I felt that I didn't know what I was doing. I felt that it was a tough project for me. It was much more difficult than my first book, A Simple Plan.
Yeah. Well, I also know that you wrote half of this book without an outline and then kind of stylized a plan beforehand. Was there any difference in with A Simple Plan? You had this really meticulously detailed 30-page outline.
Yeah.
What were the differences between the two sort of writing experiences here in terms of writing off the cuff? Did you feel the need to kind of the urgency or the impulse, perhaps, of writing this?
I think that with A Simple Plan, I felt so much more confident in what I was doing. I don't know if it was just because I was really young and naive about that, or because I had the outline. I had a real sense of the type of book that I was trying to write, the kind of noir type thing set in the Midwest. I knew what I was doing. Whereas with The Ruins, I was winging it, and I had that anxiety of winging it, you know.
Gotcha.
I felt like just someone who's never skied, and I got on a pair of skis and just heading down the hill, and I kept waiting for, you know, the bad crash that was going to happen. So,
Well, I mean, you know, at what point did the outlines, did you feel comfortable once the outline was into place, or did you feel a sense that you kind of needed some sort of guiding kind of plan for this, or a simple plan?
Yeah. I think, I mean, the outline definitely helped, but I think all along the way, it's a weird story. I think, as is true, maybe generally with horror, it's the sort of thing that if you take a step to the side, a very small step, it just becomes preposterous. And so I think writing it, I was very anxious about that. You know, I couldn't, you know, friends would say, oh, well, what's your book about? And I, you know, well, I couldn't really tell them, because if you reduce it to, you know, a simple sentence, it just sounds preposterous, sounds ludicrous. Yeah. And I think that was haunting me as I wrote. I had this sense that, you know, it's something that's very, very silly, but you have to take it as if it's very serious as you write it. And that tension, I think, was tough.
I'm not sure if you're familiar. There was a book that came out earlier this year, or actually last year, called Divided Kingdom by Rupert Thompson.
I know Rupert Thompson. I didn't know.
Yeah, he has. It's a similar kind of preposterous premise. And in fact, I got the pleasure to talk with him too, but we were talking about this notion of having a sort of a premise that it's safe to say that we could probably talk about plant life in terms of this podcast. It's not giving anything away, but in terms of like a preposterous premise,
right?
And actually the process of making it believable. What in your mind did you do to sort of, when did you sort of, what rules did you sort of set down for yourself to kind of make this plant premise, something that was, you know, believable? When did what did you do? What was the sort of, you know, how did you structure this?
I think some of it was staying. The book is told through the four main characters' points of view. You rotate through, and I think staying so strictly within that, so that you're seeing what the characters see, and so you're trying to imagine. You just take the premise as a given, and you're imagining, well, what is this person experience given that premise? So you're never stepping back and doing an overview of it. I think was important. And there's this weird balancing act where, on the one hand, while you're writing it, you have to take it very seriously as if it is this given reality, but never allowing yourself to take it seriously. There's just this weird sort of line that you have to walk. At least for myself, that's how I experienced it.
Well, what are we talking about here in terms of walking the line? I mean.
just in terms of that, taking your, like, you can't take yourself seriously, I don't think, or I couldn't, as I, you know, I'm writing. This isn't War and Peace, you know, and yet to not take the story seriously that within it. The world that you're creating, to ever let that slip and sort of wink, you know, at it, I think everything would fly apart. And so that's the line that I'm talking about.
So the sense I'm getting is that it was a kind of impulse versus a kind of hesitation on your part.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I guess it's the I mean, probably just to reduce it, it'd be like the creative intelligence versus the critical intelligence. And it's you have to keep some measure of that critical eye going, but if you turn it up too high, everything would collapse. And so it was finding that, modulating those two different aspects.
Did you find yourself turning it up too high? Because I know that you wrote this, in for the most part, as I understand it, in one sort of, well, two giant rushes,
right,
essentially.
Right.
Did you? How many drafts did this thing go through? I mean, and what were there measures that you sort of took where you felt that you were kind of turning the flames up too high, or?
I mean, I tend to rewrite as I go along. And I did some rewriting after I'd submitted it to my editor and she had some feedback. But the major stuff I do day by day as I move forward. In terms of taking things too far, it was more that I would reach a point and I would know that I could go in one direction or another, and it was finding that I had the instinct that for this story to work within the genre, I had to push towards some extremity and some to take the choice that was most uncomfortable or disturbing. But but how far to go with that, I guess, was the balancing act. Yeah.
But I guess you must have hit some sort of point as you were writing this where, you know, okay, we've got the plants, they're capable of these many things, right. and I'm so far in that I've got to keep going with this.
Right.
I mean, what, you know, at what point did you kind of, I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out, at what point did you feel the need to sort of revise the outline? Was the outline sort of this kind of assurance for you that, like, okay, yes, the story is okay, that I'm not, like, batshit insane?
No, I mean, I think that, I'm still not certain of that, actually. And certainly when I during the process, I was not, I never had that assurance, oh, this is working. I mean, I have, just at large, I have difficulty finishing things. And part of what I think helped me finish this was the fact that I wrote a chunk of it, and then I went off and I did a screenplay. And my agent sent the portion that I had out and got me in advance, and so I had to finish it. And I don't know that I would have gone back. I mean, I remember telling my wife, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, it's like, so I don't know that it may have just been shoved on a shelf if I hadn't done that. So
you're the kind of writer, it seems, and I know you've done a lot of screenplays in the right. interim between the two novels, but right. You're the kind of writer who needs to constantly be working on like maybe three things at once. And then,
yeah, and you know. I'm constantly feeling terrible about whatever it is. The grass is always greener, you know, one house over, two house, three houses over. And I mean, I think the screenwriting, I finish things because generally I'm being hired to write a screenplay, and so I have to get it done. And I definitely have an internal, I have a problem just feeling like something's good enough to send it out. Yeah.
Well, I know that before this, you actually wrote a novel or started a novel that reached Grady Tripp-like sort of proportions.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe you can talk about this a little bit. I mean, this was like something like 1,000 pages. It seems like you're trying to combat this urge not to finish, and yet it was expanding.
Expanding, yeah. And that was maybe a quarter of the way done when I stopped.
1,000 pages?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're back.
Okay.
So we had a very mysterious door open behind you. We found out that there was creepy things there, but no. But talking about this whole this novel beforehand and this idea of trying to kind of, you know, finish something
right,
with this particular
right.
book, maybe you can continue with your answer. That
the story about it was a feud in a small town, and it started out that I wanted to tell almost a short story about all the different characters that are involved in this feud. And then the short stories kind of became novellas that became novel. I mean, it just kept expanding. And I was really enjoying it. It was probably the most I've enjoyed writing was doing that. Just writing and not really worrying about where it was going to go and how it was going to arc into something. But that went on for, you know, 5 years or something. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, you know, where am I and what am I doing? And I just realized that the way that I had done it, it wasn't even like I'd, told one of those novels or novellas. I'd told the beginning of, you know, 20 of them or something. So it wasn't even like I had something that I could yank out and be useful. It was...
Sounds like some Gorman Gus.
Yeah, exactly. It was fun, but, you know, totally misguided. So.
Well, this is interesting because when I was reading this, I observed that, you know, you would... It kind of reminded me of something that Michael Moorcock, the great prolific fantasy author, he said that he would constantly sort of introduce objects or elements that he could use to sort of further his plots. And, mm-hmm. and this kind of actually relates to how you have this continuous first draft as you actually write your books. But with this, I found that there were elements you would introduce, like, for example, the tequila bottles or like the notebooks. And then sometimes you would find things to do, find ways to deal with these. And then other times they would kind of be abandoned. I mean, I kept thinking when I was reading this, like, oh, well, they're going to use tequila bottles at some point, but they really don't.
Right.
I'm just curious. This kind of, I think, you know, what you're sort of describing here with, like, you know, a novel becoming several novellas is, do you introduce objects as a way to kind of, I guess, sustain or keep plot going? Or
I think at least with the ruins, it was very much just writing what came to me with the day, and I would think, well, what do they find? And I wouldn't think, I probably should have, but I wouldn't think, oh, I'll set up the things that they find. I'll make sure they find things that will then be useful or you know, would somehow affect the plot. It was just, I imagine what they would find, and then some of, as you said, some of the times those would come into play, and some of the times I would just, it would just be something that they found without any sort of use. Yeah.
Was this an effort to kind of, I guess, further the plot or keep the reader on off guard?
No, it was just, it was the, you know, when I sat down to write The Ruins, I really didn't think, okay, I'm writing a novel. It was really, I'm trying to write again, basically. And it's, we'll see what happens with it. And so I didn't have that, overarching sort of view of it that I did with A Simple Plan, for instance, or even with this long book that I did. I had a concept that I just didn't manage to execute. But with this, it was just it just organically, I guess that's the proper word, but unfolded in that way. Yeah.
Do you find genre, because this is a horror and, right, and A Simple Plan is a noir,
right,
do you find genre kind of a help in order to finish things or to plot things
out? Yeah, I guess so. It is a bit of, I think of it as a crutch in some way. There's certain vague parameters or boundaries to it, and then you can get inside within them and play around with it in your own way. So I think, yeah, I'd like to do stuff that isn't so genre dependent, but at the same time, there are other genres I think that could be fun too. I would love to write like a chick lit book. I think that would be a lot of fun.
You know, it's funny. There's like this, there was actually this announcement I read this morning, this British talk show host saying, yes, men can't write about women at all. And there, you know, it was relating to romances in particular. And it's just, yeah, we've got to prove this wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. Actually, I wanted to ask you about something you were actually mentioning there. But shifting from this whole notion of plotting, the characters here are actually to some degree archetypal. Mm-hmm. They're very much lifted from either an '80s sex comedy or an '80s horror movie. I'm wondering why you clung to sort of characters without really kind of, you know, developing their backstory in a sort of lengthy way. I mean, it seems to me that based off of what you described in the previous novel, that it would have ended up into a novella length or something. But
I mean, that could be part of it. Actually, is a fear that I think I've my own anxiety about coming back to novel writing. I thought I'm going to just tell it. It's going to be story, and it's going to be I'm going to hit the ground. I'm just going to sprint to the end. It was my goal with it. And so I probably did as little backstory as I could get away with to make the characters, I hope, feel, relatively three-dimensional and, carry the story.
Yeah. Well, you have the so but questions of Eric and Stacy, and it suggested to me that there was this kind of neurotic indecision going on within those characters and everyone. I was going to ask you, is this book sort of like an indictment of American complacency? Or?
You know, other people have tied. I don't, and there's a lot with A Simple Plan where people felt that there were, larger themes attached to it. And I don't write that way. I wouldn't even know how to go about writing that way. I think that probably there are sentiments that, probably just culturally are out there that just get sucked into the writing. Like someone said, it's a metaphor for the Iraq War, Americans kind of hubristically going out and not knowing the language or the culture and getting in to, this hellish place. And which sounds great. I wish I thought of that. But I think that maybe that's, or other people have said, it's like a something about the environment, like kind of lashing back at us. And I think that to whatever degree those come in, they're subconscious, and it's just being part of our culture.
But at the same time, I guess the feelings in this book are actually quite similar to the feelings in A Simple Plan, in the sense that A Simple Plan deals very much with avarice.
Right.
And this one deals very much with a kind of complacency,
which are
kind of similar kind of emotions.
Yeah.
What draws you to these particular feelings? Does it make good conflict? Is that what it boils down to?
I think for me, first of all, when I really thought as I was writing The Ruins that I'm doing something, totally different. There's no overlap at all. And then people read and they point out that there are a lot of similarities. I think for me, the underlying thing that is involved in both books is the idea of people existing in a world where everything's going okay and everything is reinforcing you for being, in Simple Plan's case, a good person. The main character, Hank, is an upstanding guy in his community. But everything reinforces that. It's easy to be that. And then the temptation comes in to not do that, and his life kind of falls apart. And with this, with the ruins, I felt the way that that's linked is that these people who have these kinks in their characters, when they're all hanging out on the beach together, everything more or less is pretty good, you know? And like, yeah, Amy complains a lot, or Jeff is, you know, kind of a know-it-all or whatever, but it's all pretty happy-go-lucky and pushing people with their various personality tics into an extreme situation, and watching that scrape up against each other was, I think, an interest.
Well, the age bracket of these characters are also different, a little younger than the previous book.
Right.
I mean, what drew you to 20-somethings who just got out of college and are about to start their lives? I mean, that's a very specific age niche to concentrate
and
upon.
And probably foolish, given that I, you know nothing about what it's like to be in your young 20s nowadays. Yeah. It was just, again, it was just impulse. It was when I sat down to write, and I wrote the first little section, which is a more distant point of view before I switch in. And it just really all came out of that. I just created these characters and then I just pursued it. So it wasn't a conscious choice.
Mm-hmm. There's the sort of the conversation where they're all describing exactly how they were playing themselves in the movie, who's the funny type and who's playing who. It seems to, that part was actually very amusing to me because, again, it sort of was telling the reader, yes, you are actually sort of dealing with archetypes, and then it decides to go ahead and throw you completely off guard in terms of what happens, which I won't describe. But going again back to this question of archetypes, did you feel sort of constrained by this when you were writing, or?
Not really. I mean, I it wasn't that planned out. I mean, it really did happen organically. They kind of, as I shifted into the different points of view, they sort of became, to the degree that now that they are sort of reducible. I mean, my publisher had a website for the book where you can take a quiz and it tells you which character you are. But none of that was conscious to think, well, okay, Amy is the complainer and Jeff is the take charge guy. It was just, it kind of came together in those first scenes and then just played out accordingly.
Well, what of the international component to the book where there's all these people who are thrown into this situation, they don't speak each other's language.
Right.
This kind of had to come from somewhere. I mean, beyond just some sort of, I guess, impulse.
Right.
Maybe you can kind of describe this, because it seems to come in like... I mean, it comes in there early, but it also comes in there and really announces itself maybe at the 100-page mark
right.
that what this is a pretty troubling situation.
Right. I think I had a impulse early on, which I didn't pursue to the length that I thought I was going to pursue, about the group dynamic where the four American characters would sort of bond together, and the German guy and the Greek guy who they'd met on the beach would start to be seemed threatening in some way. They would other them in some way. And there are some phrases in the early on in the book, like, he wasn't one of us, you know. And I didn't ultimately, there's a little bit of that, but I didn't ultimately pursue that. But that was, and I think the whole language barrier, both in terms of creating the suspense and also the sense of possible threat, I think was something that I just wanted to play with.
Yeah. Are you sure you haven't slipped any checks to Stephen King? Not that he needs it, because he like raved about both books.
No,
like,
he's an incredibly generous man. I mean, not just to me, to other writers he champions.
Yeah.
I mean, the Simple Plan, as the Ruins did, actually, they both got a just very scathing negative reviews in the New York Times. And
I asked Machiko.
Yes, yeah, she's a big fan of mine.
She doesn't really like a lot of fiction, though, actually. I think she should be writing the nonfiction.
That's
anyway.
But he flew down from Maine and went on Good Morning America with me to defend, you know, the book. Just,
I didn't realize
this.
So Good Morning America books you two guys to defend against Machiko?
When A Simple Plan came out. Yeah.
Oh, when A Simple Plan. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
That's how he, you know, I met him, and he... got involved with the Simple Plan on that level. But that's just, that's a very generous man. He's hardworking, you know, just this deep, very pure love of storytelling. And I think his generosity comes out of that. He's excited about other people telling stories. It's great.
How would you, this is an obvious question, but how would you compare the, you know, process of writing a screenplay with the process of writing a novel? Do you have the same sort of stumbling block that we were kind of describing earlier in terms of, like, not being able to finish? Or, you know, do the hard deadlines and the constant meetings of the film business demand that you write?
I think I have, like, a you know, exterior locus of control. I think that, I mean, having a deadline just helps me. I think that if I were writing spec scripts and I were on my own, I'd probably have a lot of two-thirds finished scripts or half-finished scripts. And I think that the screenplays also, because of the... there is that, I mean, even more so than writing genre fiction where I talked about the boundaries or the kind of general sense of rules. I mean, the screenplays, if you're writing for Hollywood, they're pretty... there's a paradigm that you pursue, and there's a page length, and I think that creates a different sort of feel to the writing and experience of the writing. It's much shorter and condensed and focused. You know,
did you, and was there, you know, did at any point did the ruins kind of get out of control in terms of, like, you know, becoming this, like, great sort of 600-page book you had to whack down? I mean, it seems to be the constraints.
A little bit. Toward the end, when I came back to it to write the last third, it took me a while to find my way, my feet, and part of that involved going off on a just bloated tangent, basically, that I, you know, had to cut out.
And you wrote a Simple Plan this way too, in terms of, like, the continuous first draft.
Well, no, actually, I wrote a Simple Plan totally differently. I wrote, I had that outline, and then I wrote a chapter a week, my first draft. I jammed out like 30 pages a week for 12 weeks, and then it was very much a first draft. And I went back and more slowly went through, and I changed in the first draft. It takes place in New Hampshire. There are significant changes that were made between the first and the second draft, so it was different.
Yeah. And did you use computers for both? Or
I'm just wondering
what kind of got rights. Have you had what sort of causes you to maybe write differently for each particular?
I think it was the freedom when I the bloated, huge, long, epic thing that I was started. I think I felt financially from a Simple Plan. I felt like I had a certain amount of freedom. I could just write, and I think I sat down and just to a fault, I did that, which was a lot of fun, as I said, but it didn't come together. Whereas with the Simple Plan, I knew that I'd had some grant money. I had a certain amount of savings, and it was going to run out at a certain point, and I wanted to try to sell the book before that happened. So there was much more of a sense of getting it done.
So we got to get you, like, under the gun.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you a question about the internet research you did for the Yucatan. Mm-hmm. You used internet research. You didn't actually visit the place.
That's true.
And I was wondering if you feel there are, you know, any advantages or disadvantages to, you know, not visiting a place versus visiting a place and writing about it.
I mean, I'm sure that the path of integrity is to go and visit the place. I know I'm completely clear on that, and feel guilty over the fact that I didn't do that, and anxious about people who are familiar with the region just being appalled at what I've done. I mean, the bulk of the book does take place on this hill in the jungle, so it is just my imaginary region. I just had to get the characters from Cancun to that place. I wrote the book almost as a experiment or an exercise. I wrote the first part of the book, and then I was like, well, okay, should I go and visit? And I think I had a fear that I'm going to go and it's going to be nothing at all like what I've written, and I'm just going to, you know, sink into despair and, you know, curl up in a fetal position, basically. Yeah. And so I just said, well, I'll just, you know, go into deep denial and finish. So.
The other thing that's interesting is that you don't actually spell out. You keep a lot of cards close to your chest. We leave the book with a lot of unanswered questions, right. and you know, damn curious ones at that. I wanted to ask if you had set any sort of ground rules to decide what you would reveal to the reader and what you would not. Whether you know what factor was ambiguity right. apart.
Because it is told through these characters' point of view, so you could only learn what they learned, and they, at times they speculate among themselves, but it's just speculation. That's my, you know, the cloak that I hide behind, basically, for leaving so many questions unanswered. It's also, I think, as with many fantasy-based or horror novels, you can probe at it up to a certain point, at which point it'll just all fly apart and collapse. And so some of the questions are very conveniently, for me, not answered, you know.
You don't even know the answer.
Yeah, or, you know, I could throw out answers, but it's just, you know, BS, basically. So I'm definitely on down on bended knee, you know, begging for suspension of disbelief at various points, yeah.
There are two criticisms in the negative reviews, uh-huh. including Machiko. You know, Machiko called this a preposterous new screenplay, but there were two major objections. One, that this was like a movie, it wasn't a novel, right. And two, the more surprising one for me anyway, was like, oh, there's all this gore, there's all this like, you know, terrible sort of stuff. Right. I mean, you know, let's talk about this. I mean, why do you think that there is this kind of notion about what a novel should be that kind of gets people's feathers ruffled? Is this a popular versus literary kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Is this, you know, I mean, because, you know, I read it, and yes, you know, I have to confess, you know, like, you know, being gripped like this, that's a tremendous skill. You know, I for God's sakes, I, you know, there went my weekends.
Just, appreciate it.
Yeah.
I think there is a... I think there's a feeling of certain reviewers that they're in a position of kind of defending the sanctity of literary fiction against, and I can kind of understand. I understand. I don't agree, but I can understand where they're coming from, and that sense of being besieged or embattled by our popular culture. You know, which I think. There's a big difference between Alice Munro, you know, and The Ruins. And I think that you know, the Ruins is ultimately more commercial than and sells more and gets more attention than a lot of literary fiction. And I can understand the sense of feeling that that's really, you know, not right and that's screwed up. And my own reading tastes actually tend toward more literary fiction. I don't really read a lot of the stuff that I write, yeah. basically. Yeah. So I can kind of, especially even Machiko's reviews, which are, they're sort of almost like performance art. I mean, she really, and I enjoy them. I enjoy them, you know, when I'm not the subject of them. So I don't feel... I can't really get all outraged that, you know, she went in and, you know, gutted my book, because I feel like she sees herself as serving some sort of purpose. And I think people who read the reviews and who read at large, they know what kind of book they're looking to buy, you know, and I don't think people who are picking up Alice Munro are mistakenly picking up, you know, things with the level of gore that The Ruins has.
But at the same time, you could look at a book like, you know, look at an Ian McEwan book like mm-hmm. Atonement.
Right.
And this has the same level of gripping plot that you can't put down, and yet it's told in a different sort of way.
Right.
Or you look at something like Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, which is right. also done without chapter breaks.
That's true. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, there are certain similarities.
Right.
Where does one draw the distinction, or should there even be a distinction?
I think there is also a especially, I think, the horror genre is there's a distaste for just the components of it, I think, including the level of gore, you know, which I felt writing it, I felt was very necessary to, you know, playing around in that genre was to keep that, for me as a reader, I would expect that, I think.
Yeah. So. in terms of, like, you know, beyond just simple storytelling, I mean, what was the other additional elements of this that drove you to write this? I mean, was it to tell a well-told story? Was it, you know, or was there something else that kind of?
I think it was the storytelling mostly, I think, you know, getting back into prose and just the descriptive passages and it was a joy to do that after doing the screenwriting, which is much more stripped down and probably ultimately less rich, you know, less dense.
Okay. Yeah. I guess the other question I have, I mean, I'm just thinking back to this 1,000-page effort of yours and just trying to sort of get a sense of, like, you know, you seem very driven by plot. You seem very driven by, you know, having really tough deadlines as right. well. And I'm just trying to also, you know, see if there's, like, additional elements of Scott Smith, the writer here, that I'm, you know, I'm just, I mean, that drove you to write this kind of expansive sort of, like, you know, potentially 4,000-page book, you know?
I think it was that sense of freedom. I think I just felt that, you know, I was pretty young. I felt like I had sort of all the time in the world to just write and be. I mean, I know that it was ultimately tragic story. You know, it wasn't playful in the sense of the story, but it felt like play. Like while I was writing it, I was just kind of let myself go, I think.
Do you feel, did you feel, though, like, you know, dwelling so much on storytelling that you are, in some sense, you know, manipulating other people's emotions or the reader's kind of sense of, like, you know, oh, I'm stuck to this or anything like that?
I think I enjoyed, the original impulse to try something in the horror genre was the watching a movie where I jumped, and I wanted to see whether I could write something that would make people feel that. So there is that sense of pushing people's buttons, I guess.
So about the chapter breaks and about not having any. I mean, what was the decision behind that?
I think it's an effect of the rotating points of view, which at times mean that the same incident is told from different perspectives. The very condensed timeline. So there was no natural break. There was no, you know, well, 3 weeks are going to pass or something. It was continuous. It just felt, instinctively, it just felt right to me that not to have that moment where you stop is just carrying you forward.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't really get into this so much. We were talking about this earlier about the multinational component of the lack of communication, mm-hmm. and I didn't really get an answer from you on that. Maybe you can, I was just curious as to whether there was something beyond the sort of miscommunication element within the book that drove the multinational sort of presence.
No, it was really the that initial impulse to have the group dynamic and the people being othered in some way, coupled with the way that I think limiting the characters' understanding of each other, I hoped, increase the suspense.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the other question I had, and this is largely because I really loved the film version of Simple Plan as well as the book, and that is, I was curious about your collaboration with Sam Raimi. Did they pretty much keep hands off of the script, or was this all you?
The script was. It took 5 years to write. There were five different directors, and so there's so many different versions, and he actually came in at a place where the script was essentially done. We changed a few small things. I loved working with him. He's a funny guy and just, you know, very dryly, kind of wickedly funny. But in terms of the script, most of the big changes that occurred in the script from the book were actually the producer, Scott Rudin's input. He was very helpful.
Yeah, because I was curious. Cause, I mean, you know, I think the movie is very much contingent upon your script as well as. I mean, it's definitely a sort of like a major kind of maturing point for Sam Raimi, and so I'm wondering. This is why I've always wondered the sort of connection between you and Raimi in terms of actually going ahead and doing this. Whether it was inherently there, or whether he whether you were, I mean, I don't know, I've never read the script, how descriptive was the script for a lot of these, you know, the shots of the books closing the little niches and things like that. Was that your idea or was that Sam's?
That was in the script, actually. But there's, I mean, Sam brought so much to it. Sam actually was interested. He wanted to do a much earlier, the draft actually that I did with Ben Stiller, which was much more kinetic and closer to the book. It was more of a thriller. And when he came on, he wanted to go back to that. Billy Bob Thornton was already attached, and in that draft, he would die in the middle of the story, and in the Scott Rudin draft, he'd die at the end. And so he was not thrilled about going back to the earlier draft. And so Sam, you know, found some newfound enthusiasm for the later draft. And,
Got it. Now, The Ruins, I guess, is you're writing the script for that right now.
Yes.
Where are you at on that?
I've done a draft. I've got notes from the studio, and I'm incorporating the notes. Actually, interestingly, I mean, it's been a bizarre experience because the notes are really about pushing it back closer to the book rather than whatever changes I've made to try to condense or shift things a little bit. They have been, so it's been a kind of bizarre, surreal experience because that's not usually the studio experience, you know. Like, they want me to, you know, take more time in the beginning and set up the characters more. And yeah. So, but,
well, I fear, because, you know, doing the CGI for the vines.
Yes.
I fear that they might screw that up.
Yeah. Well,
might look like snakes on a plane.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's out of my hands.
Yeah, exactly.
Above my pay grade.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.